Blog Talk Radio.
To another edition of the Ishinru Matt's podcast. Tonight we have our featured guest waiting in the wings to come on, Phil Torres. And we always like to give some shout-outs at the top of the program, give thanks to our founder, Shimabuku Tatsuo Sensei, the first generation students, and all of their grand black belts for the work that they've done to promote Ishinru worldwide. Good evening, everybody. My name is Danny Vella. Today is May 25th, 2022. It's 7 o'clock in the evening, Eastern Standard Time. And again, we're looking forward to working very closely with the community to build awareness with what's going on basically on a day-to-day basis. We're just asking for can we try to share a little love with everybody? Tonight's program is all about a martial arts practice that has spanned over several decades. So, again, our special guest is Phil Torres. He is a very experienced martial artist, and we're very excited to have him on the program. So, let's bring him on. I'm going to give him a round of applause, and we'll bring him on the program. Thank you, thank you. Welcome to the program, Phil.
Thank you, sir. I'm just honored that you asked me to come on the show and communicate, interact with your many listeners, and I'm just happy to be here. In the martial arts, I started in martial arts in 1961 and still involved to a degree. Very much so, helping friends run events, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
Awesome. Well, since you told us that you got started in 1961, I guess we'll get in the car, we'll take a drive back to 1961, and we'll ask this question. How was the workouts back then? Like, what was it like?
Well, in 1960, well, they were tough. And tough, by tough, I mean they were different than going into a dojo today. And sometimes it wasn't a dojo. It was whatever makeshift situation you can get. In my case, my older brother, Jose, he passed away now, but his friend had returned from the Air Force in Japan. He was stationed in Japan. He studied jiu-jitsu in Japan. And at least twice a week for a couple of years, we got into the church basement of Our Lady of Victory Church, starting summer of 61, and we would be throwing each other around until we could not get up anymore. And it was fantastic. It gave me a taste for the martial arts. Moved on from there to about 1964-ish. I decided to join this was the church basement in the South Bronx New York City. But about 1964, I was interested in learning karate as opposed to the other arts. And I joined the Shotokan dojo on the several miles from the house off the rail train line in near Fordham Road. And then attending that dojo for a few years, the mid-60s came around, and I was torn between making a decision. I used to attend the S. Hungry Cho tournaments down in Manhattan in the 60s. Not yet a black girl at that time. And I was caught up in the practice of martial arts. I was in the mid 60s. I was torn between trying to follow the footsteps of somebody like Peter Urban, who went to Japan to study with the masters and then come back and establish his own style, USA Goju, or joining the Marine Corps. And the Marine Corps won, so I joined the Marine Corps, and I decided that I had the best of both worlds. And the career that really, really interested me, and I got to a location where I can practice the martial arts as I wanted to.
You covered a lot of ground there, Bill. There's like some of the people that you're interacting with. When you said you went to tournaments, with the great S. Henry Cho, obviously those times and those dates, martial arts was developing in this country.
Yes.
And it is that era of martial arts where we consider that the pioneer years, because no one knew what taekwondo or karate. They may have known judo, that name, but I don't think they really knew what it was. They might have thought it was some kind of oriental wrestling or something, whatever. But again, martial arts in 1961 in the Bronx was not a common thing like a bakery, like it is now. So
no.
It has to be noted that in this time, you're doing work where others are not doing things like that. They're not practicing. They may be in school doing wrestling, or they may be in school boxing, but it was not anything mainstream at this time. So that has to be noted to us, because it's much like you said, the workouts were different.
Yes.
Sometimes you didn't even have a building to go in. You just maybe might have gone in the park or something, or in your backyard, whatever.
Absolutely.
Just to be able to practice these movements. Now, I have written down here, so far I was trying to follow you, but I have written down here, around 1964, you got into karate in the Bronx, Shotokan. Something about Fordham in the Bronx.
Yeah, it was close to Fordham Road.
Fordham Road.
It was Kabuto School of Karate.
I didn't get that clearly. What was the name of it?
Yeah. Kabuto School of Karate. And that was in the Bronx.
And the sensei there?
Yeah, the sensei there at that time was Vincent Buddha. And he was a brown belt. But
okay.
he was more experienced. He'd been a brown belt for like 20 years. He was more experienced than any karateka I had witnessed anywhere, including going down to the tournaments downtown. He just didn't care to be promoted. And the head of the school had moved to Japan to study in Japan. So he had the school, Vincent had the school, as a Brown, but again, we're talking about somebody who had been in karate, pure karate, for decades.
Yes, yeah. And then you mentioned this name, S. Henry Cho. Now, there was a dojo, help me with this, I want to say at Midtown around the 50s, upstairs, S. Henry Cho had a location in Manhattan.
Yes.
Around the 50s, the 56th Street, something like that. And it was upstairs, Bill.
Yes.
And I remember
and,
going
but,
there. I remember.
But what I remember most is the pictures that were burned into my memory watching people like Thomas Lepopit fight. He was such a skilled fighter that it was just like watching an opera, just like watching a show. It was a pleasure to watch him. And then you had people like Dr. Meng Ji come in and put on a demo, and everybody was mesmerized. And then you had somebody like George Cofield, who was Thomas Lepopit's sensei, and put on a demo, and I was just blown away. And then you had Peter Urban come on stage. I think he was a Nidan at that time, and put on a demo, and all these figures just motivated me to get more involved in the arts, and that's what led to making a decision later as to whether I wanted to join the Marines or go overseas to Japan and just dedicate myself to studying the arts in the East.
Well, you know, the names that you've mentioned here are, again, they're part of that pioneer era of martial arts.
Yes,
here in the United States.
Yes, they
How
are.
How about Dr. Moses Powell? Did you ever cross paths with Dr. Moses Powell?
I've never had a chance to interact with him one-on-one, but I knew him and I knew of him. And everybody that, and I worked on the weekends, I would go away from my Shotokan dojo and I would study with people from all the various different arts, including some of the students of Moses Powell. So I had a chance to interact with them, but I never had any one-on-one directly with Moses Powell.
So again, Phil, the idea of working out, learning these movements, whether it be from this discipline or that discipline, you're at a point now in your martial arts study that when you mention people like Peter Urban and Cofield Sensei and Fit Sensei, I mean, he was a fireman, wasn't he?
He was a Marine and a fireman because he stayed in the reserves. And then later on in life, and we're talking, you know, years later, and then decades later, I had a chance to interact with him one-on-one because he was a first sergeant in the Marine Corps Reserve. And he would come down to Camp Lejeune for his drill weekends, drill periods. And I used to, I had a small dojo that I took over in 1967 in Jacksonville, North Carolina. And then Thomas Lepopit would be in town and he would stop in, and then he would just take, and I would just tend the class over to him because I just loved watching him perform and watching him teach and watching him break everything down to explain every technique, whether it's a kick or a punch or a block. So I just used to sit on the side. It was my class, but I would sit, step off to the side, and he would take over my class, and then we would interact. And then about a couple of decades later, I got to interact with him again when I was the commander of the Marine Security Forces in South Georgia at the submarine base. And so I got to see that. That was in 67 when he used to come into my dojo. In 97, I got to say goodbye to him for the last time. He had terminal cancer, and he had about 3 months to live. And in Orlando, they put together a tribute tournament to Thomas LePuppet before he passed away. And Jody Paul, I used to be part of Jody Paul's dojo in Georgia while I was stationed there. He invited me into his dojo. And Jody Paul and I went to Orlando to participate, but primarily to give tribute. And I got some of my most memorable pictures I got with him. Jody Paul and I with Thomas LePuppet about 3 months before he passed away. He left Orlando, and then he was going to get an award down in South Africa somewhere, and then right after that he passed away as predicted.
Well, you know, we can't understand why things like that happen. But they
no,
do.
No, we don't. Yes.
And when they do, it brings me to one of the people that I wanted to bring up his name, and that's Rick Namira.
Rick Namira I could say he was one of my heroes, but I think he was a hero to everybody that I surrounded myself with. Carl Hovey and I used to teach together, and we spent a lot of time together, and we traveled together all over the East Coast, up and down the East Coast, to compete together. And Rick Namira was part of this team, and my most memorable times was in the summer times, during the summers, this is in the mid-70s, we would... The Bondo system, Dr. Mong G and Bob Maxwell, they'll put together a camp where we would practice all of the arts and we would do many things. We would just go out there up in the mountains of West Virginia for a whole week or almost a week and do nothing but martial arts day and night, except when we were eating. So it's an exciting time.
Can you share with our loyal listeners what kind of a man Rick Namira was?
Rick, an extremely knowledgeable martial artist, great mentor, great coach, spent time on the range together, competing against each other because Bob Maxwell, Rick, myself, and Mark would be the instructors running some people through the marksmanship portion of the camp. And then we would compete with each other. Rick was always this positive force never a bad word to anyone, always motivating, always setting the example. When he passed away, we were all sad, and we miss him dearly, and he will continue to live in our hearts. But he was a special person to me.
And I would just like to say this at the end of that statement, Phil, that you called him a hero of yours.
Yes.
And he was certainly, you know, a hero to me as well, because I could only aspire to be, you know, like Sensei. He was, he just was a very special man. He had an intestinal fortitude like no other. He was cut out of a piece of granite. He was just the toughest, most, you know, feared fighter I ever stepped on the deck with. And I, as young as I was, he was just so gracious with me. You know, he... he could have made scrambled eggs out of me, but made me a much better fighter, a much better karateka, and also gave me the courage to continue when it was very difficult for me. So he is all the things that you said: a mentor, a great coach, a great sensei, a great father, a great brother. He was just a great everything. Everything he did.
And absolutely. And I think he affected everyone the same way.
Oh,
everyone that I knew at that time. Everybody, wherever he went. He was with the D.C. Police force. He was a sergeant with the D.C. police force. I believe he had a helicopter. Great guy.
He was. He really was. Thank you. Thank you for, you know, saying what you said about him, because he was just, he deserves every bit of it. He left us too early. He had much more work to do, but yes, the work that the Creator wanted him for, he had to serve. So,
yes.
But what a guy. What a guy. I loved him so much. I really did. So now
we all did.
You know.
And we all miss him.
You know, yes, we all miss him. I know. I know. As you said, when he passed, we were all very, very sad. I never saw Ed McGrath cry, even when his mom passed away. But when Sensei Rick died, he put his head in his hands and broke down. That's
wow.
What a guy. I mean, what a Marine. You know what I mean?
Yes.
What a Marine.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
The
I agree.
Awesome. So, again. And now, how about Don Nagle? Did you ever get to meet Don Nagle?
I have met Don Nagle. I've never had the opportunity to work out in his class. But I've met him at various different tournaments, and I've got to meet many of his students. So, yes, I knew him,
yeah.
I met him, we spoke, but I was never one of his students.
Well, my sensei, obviously, I'm sure you know that Ed McGrath trained under Don. So
yes.
Coming up through the ranks, we used to go to Don's dojo in Jersey City. And he was a character. He was a very colorful character, Don Nagle. You know, he was, the time, he was a detective. And he was working in some very difficult areas. So he was a tough guy, all right? Don was a tough guy. If you mess with Don, you were gonna wake up in the hospital. So we got to work out with this guy. And let me tell you, his students and him were as tough as nails. They all fought like warriors, okay? And whenever we would go up there, whether it was for a workout or a promotion, or because we always did things with his permission. And,
yes.
You know, that was Ed Sensei, so we didn't do anything without Don's, you know, let's go see, you know, Don and his students, and we'll test up there. So
right. It
was always very exciting because, you know, there was a little competition between the dojos, Ed McGrath's guys and Don's guys, you know. So it was
absolutely
very exciting, but very competitive, as you know, Phil. Very competitive.
Yes, I do.
A lot of us walked out of there with things that we'll never, ever forget.
I fully understand the statement.
Yeah, guys were top-notch martial artists, okay? So,
yes.
Coming up through the ranks, because that's my lineage. It's Nagel, you know, McGrath, and then myself, so... The idea of being Ed's son-in-law, that didn't help me any because I was close to Sensei. Yeah, I was close to Sensei. But
did you? I'm sure you had a chance to meet Donald Bohan, right?
Well, now there's another man now, you know. But when I made fifth degree black belt, he came to. Because that's like a big deal to us, Phil. When you make fifth degree black belt, Sensei's acknowledge you now to go and be a full-fledged teacher, that you know the syllabus, you can teach the curriculum, you can do the drills, you can do all the things that they're asking you to do. So now
right. We
talked about two of Sensei's best friends in the world. Is Rick Namira and Don Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I grew up around these two guys. And let me tell you something. Sensei would describe Bohan like this. If he got shot 50 times, you'd have to tap him on the shoulder and say, excuse me, Sensei, you've been shot 50 times.
That sounds about
because
right.
That sounds about right, okay? So Bohan Sensei is... he came specifically to my fifth dan promotion and handed me a certificate from his dojo.
Wow.
When I posted it online, they said, you can't post that. That's from Don. That's from Don Bowen. I said, well, if you look at what it says there, it's to me. Don made that to me. You know what I mean? He came for me.
Right.
Gave me
right.
that certificate. And, I have very, very fond memories of those two gentlemen. Rick Namira and Don Bohan.
Yeah.
Working out in the backyard with these two guys was a challenge. So now imagine when Nagel would come to Long Island and... Now, in Sensei's backyard, you got Don Nagel, Ed McGrath, Rick Namira, Don Bohan, Steinberg, Bobby Baker.
Yes.
Me. And Jimmy Gaccione. When we pair up, when the group pairs up, you could be paired up with Don Nagel.
Right.
You know, so
remember
exciting.
It later.
Oh my God. I mean, his knuckles, he was a skinny guy, but he hit like
I remember.
Oh, he hit like a he was unbelievable. So again, I have such a love for these people because they shared with me something that gave me the courage to not be bullied anymore.
Right.
And not be hurt. I wouldn't get beat up going to school anymore because I would know how to get out of there. Taught me, no, you don't fight. You just get out of there.
That's the reason why I started studying jiu-jitsu in the church basement, because I had trouble getting home from school in the South Bronx.
I know. I was born and bred in New York City myself. My parents moved us to Long Island when I was about 8 years old from Queens. But it was no better on Long Island. So it was still... It was still the jungle.
Right. No, I fully understand that. Did you meet Bob Maxwell from the Bondo system?
I just invited him. Yes. I just invited him on the program. He says, I have a little bit of the flu, so let me get better, and then I'll come on the show. He said, we'll do the show.
He too is one of my heroes. He's and whenever there was a Bondo training camp, whether it was for a weekend or for a week for the summer, he would make sure that Carl Hovey and I was stationed at Quantico, and Carl Hovey and I were teaching together at his dojo, Carl's dojo in Fredericksburg. But Bob Maxwell will always make sure that Carl Hovey and I accompany him and made the Bondo camp, so that Bondo and Ishinru had a bonding, a very strong bond together that nobody could break.
I still wear the black trim at the bottom of my gi pants for that reason.
Good.
For the recognition of Ishinru and Bondo.
Yes. Rick really cemented that in, and he would talk about the special bond that we had. And Bob was just one of my heroes.
Well, again, you see, there's continuity, Phil.
Yes,
we're going through some. Yeah, we're going through some time now, and the familiarity of, I guess, the longevity that we both had in martial arts. I started my first class was in 1972, so you see, ever since, my sensei was. Fortunate enough to be out there with Aaron Banks when Aaron Banks was doing all the tournaments.
Right.
The other gentleman who had the magazine, who's the gentleman who had the magazine? I can't remember his name.
Ed Parker was one of the ones who ran a lot of tournaments.
Yes, I competed in them.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I know. The tournament scene back then again was something new, and that's how my sensei got his nickname as the voice of karate, because at the Manhattan Center he would introduce karate, judo, jiu-jitsu, and all this stuff, and he would tell the audience, "This is what it is. This is karate. This is judo." And they would do demonstrations, and all these great martial artists would come in. And again, in like 1966, that he was working on Wall Street, Ed McGrath, and he got exposed to this company, Lehman Paquin, who was sponsoring this new cologne called High Karate.
Right.
And
okay.
Because he was in martial arts, his hands and that jump kick on the gift box set is Ed McGrath.
I didn't know that.
I swear to God.
Wow.
So, again, we have such a wide variety of exposure Sensei after work, when we both worked in Manhattan, because I used to work for Sensei, we would stop in at Yoshimitsu Yamada Sensei. And he was an Aikido teacher, very famous, by the way.
Right.
Yoshimitsu Yamada, very, I think he studied directly under the founder of Aikido.
Okay.
Morihei Ueshiba.
Yeah. Yes, Ueshiba.
Yeah. Ueshiba. Yeah, thank you. So to work in the presence of a man who moves just like Moses Powell, silently. As big as Moses Powell was, he moved silently. If anything, you might have heard his gi move. But him,
right.
As for taking steps on the deck, he was silent. Same thing with Ronald Duncan. Now, there's a man that goes back with my sensei from the days of Camp Lejeune, Jacksonville, North Carolina, in that dojo with Ernie Cates. I think it was Ernie Cates and his wife. They were teaching judo. And then Don Nagel come in with the Ishin Ryu. And that's where Bohan and all those guys, Alexander, all those guys got together. And here we are today now. I mean, you know, that's again, we always like to thank. The, yes, sir.
The Master Ronald Duncan used to put on a demo along with Dr. Meng Ji and Peter Urban. And Joe Schofield, the four of them used to put on memos, and all four of them mesmerized me. They were so efficient. They were so good. You couldn't help but just, you know, your mouth is wide open, just, and your eyes are wide open. You know, how can anyone do that? Their timing, their speed, their knowledge, their movement, the efficiency of movement was so good that all of that together drew me in to continue to study the arts forever. And then Ronald Duncan, when he passed away, the system was left to another good friend of mine who recently passed away, and that was Rick Wigginton, another Marine, who was just, I was honored to know him. He was just a great person, a great sensei. He was the head of the style now when Ronald Duncan passed. And then Rick Wigginton passed away, I think, in 2016. And we all miss him, too. But another great sensei.
Well, we were very intimate with Duncan Sensei because they, again, they were together from the very beginning, Ed and Ronald. And we were from Long Island. So, you know, going there to his dojo, him coming to our dojo was frequent. And I have to agree with you. Out of all the martial artists I've ever seen in my life, I have to say Professor Duncan was something to – he was mesmerizing.
He was one of a kind.
Absolutely. That's right.
Go ahead. And his number one student, Rick Wigginton, was similar to him.
Of course. However, to be in the presence of greatness, you come away with, one, the knowledge, two, in awe of what you just saw, and then three, once it's in you now, once you've been there and he has shown you what he expects to see you do in your drills. You know, again, it's something that, you know, his two boys, Ronald Jr. and Gregory, do a great
right.
job of honoring their father
yes.
with the Way of the Winds system
yes.
that O-Sensei gave to us to cherish as a gift, because it is a gift. And I always said that that man could make a weapon out of anything. I mean, a blade of grass, for God's sake. I mean,
right.
he can make a weapon out of anything. And again, I will say this,
but,
Marine. What a Marine.
Yes. Well, isn't that what ninjutsu is all about? Creating a weapon out
yes.
of anything. Out of thin air.
Anything. That's right. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Colonel. I'm sorry.
I get
so excited when we talk about these people.
Well, I'm excited too because we're walking down this memory lane that we both cherish. But another experience that I had, and I'm sure you know him, and I'll tell you what happened, is Bill Hayes.
Yes.
Probably
yes.
The best kata man that I have ever witnessed.
Yes.
Especially weapons katas. Now, for example, in 1969, after coming back from Vietnam, I was stationed at Camp Lejeune. And one day, I'm at the Getchi Memorial Fieldhouse, and I'm teaching a class to about maybe four students. Okay, on one side of the gym. On the other side of the gym is this person who I had never met, but somehow got my attention. Bill Hayes was teaching on the other side. He had one of his black belts with him. Bill Hayes was a Sandan at that time, and he had one of his students, black belt students, with him. But when I'm teaching my class and I look over to the side, and this guy is nothing but perfection in motion. You can see where a fist started. You can see where the fist ended, but you don't see anything in between. You can see where the kick started. You can see where the kick ended, but nothing in between. He was that fast. He was that smooth. He was that efficient. Okay. I stopped my class, and I took them over to the other side of the gym just so we can watch him. That was my introduction to Bill Hayes in 1969. He was that good that I said, let's go here. Let me show you what karate at a much higher level looks like. So,
isn't that wonderful when you see that?
Oh, absolutely. And to be able to appreciate it, you know, and not
yes.
and not you know, shrug it off because it's somebody from some other style or anything. No, I gravitated to whatever interested me out there, and we went over and we watched and we learned.
Well, I would agree with you that out of the practitioners that I've been around, he is one of the finest. As you said, poetry in motion.
Yep.
Everything is
yep.
Everything is crisp, clean, economy of movement, and just
yep.
awesome, awesome.
Yes, he was,
I,
and
you know,
he
I,
is. Yeah.
I could only aspire to be like people like that, but I'll tell you what. I will spend the rest of my life trying. Because I've seen it, and I just try my best to emulate it. And as you said, it's a journey that we cherish.
Yes.
We did a lot of work.
Much so.
Over the years, I mean, we did a lot of work.
We'll cherish it until we take our last breath.
I often wonder when the time comes, all of the work that we did, one of the questions that I like to ask the people that we speak to here on the program, impact. We spoke about all these names tonight, Peter Urban and S. Henry Cho, the Puppet Sensei, Cofield Sensei, just all these people.
Yes.
The impact that they've had on us. Now, yes, they may have passed on, but they still live in us because of the impact that they had on us. As you said,
yes,
when you watch Bill Hayes do kata, you were like, "Come here, guys, let me show you something. This is the way you got to. This is it here."
That's basically what I did. I stopped and I explained to the guys, this is what it's supposed to look like.
Okay.
I literally did that.
Well, again, impact from these people, from these pioneers, is so profound that they had no idea. I'm sure when Sensei Hayes was over in the corner there doing his kata, he was working out. But he had such an impact that you stopped your class to come here. Let me show you something.
Absolutely.
Well, now, Phil, that impact has lasted for years and years and years. You're still talking about it today.
That's so, over a half century ago.
All right.
That's 53 years ago that I met him.
Think of that impact. All right.
Yes.
They don't realize it.
No, they don't.
You don't realize.
I hope they do.
Well, no, Phil, listen. They don't spend enough time thinking about it. You don't realize, personally, Phil Torres, you don't realize the impact you've had on so many people. Only because you just don't spend time thinking about it. But
no, I always hope that I have had a positive impact on those that I interacted with along the way.
All right, well, here, since we are both martial artists, you got to push-pull the yin-yang. So even if it's positive or negative, you've had an impact, a profound impact on so many people.
I agree 100%.
Well, first of all, you're a colonel in the Marine Corps. So just saying that, forget about the fact that you're a martial artist, but just being a colonel in the Marine Corps, the impact that you've had on all those Marines, sir, is profound.
Well, the fact that there is not a month that I don't get something from one of my Marines somewhere, and I'm talking in many, 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 one, because I had a lot of command time, but I get a lot of interaction from Marines through the decades that just make me smile.
All right, now let me stop you.
So one day, one or two or three of them would say, "Well, sir, I gotta be honest with you. You're the best commanding officer I had." And I've had that said to me by many, and that alone is enough to make me smile at my last breath.
Okay. So now,
and
you know.
Now, we didn't go overseas into some of the overseas senseis that also had an impact, who's had an impact on me.
Would you mind sharing some of that with us?
Absolutely. Again, I'm an eclectic martial artist, even though Ishiru is in my heart. I'm an eclectic. I'm going to learn from wherever I can. One of the first people that had a significant impact on me was Angie Uesu Hanchi, in Okinawa, the son-in-law of Grandmaster Tatsuo Shimabuku. he kind of took me under his wing when I first met him, and he I impressed him when I first met him working out, and I helped in the dojo and all that, and he was so impressed, and then he invited me over to his house. He had a dojo on the second floor of his house, and then just the two of us working out. And you posted one of those pictures in of me. That's at his house. He and I working out for a couple hours. So he had a significant impact. And then also during the 70s, during my 77 to 78 tour in Okinawa, for example, as the same week that I got to Okinawa in 77, I heard that weekend there was a karate tournament at Kadena. There was the Okinawan championship tournament at Kadena Air Force Base. And I said, well, that should be exciting to see. So I wanted to make sure that I saw it. And then I said, now, wait a minute. I'm in pretty good shape. I've done okay. I'm gonna enter this tournament. I did. And I won all my fights. And I was in fairly good shape. I had recently won the Sika Championship, the Southeast Karate Association Championship that Donald Bohan used to put on in North Carolina. I was feeling pretty confident. And that championship was run by Grandmaster Fusei Kise. So I wound up fighting for the Grand Championship with his son. And that, at the end, and that impressed him so much that he said, come here, you come with me. You train with me. So Grandmaster Kise at that time took me under his wing, Shorinru, and I started practicing with him. And then I would still go back and visit with Grandmaster Uesu, Hangi Uesu, Vishnu, but I spent a lot of time with Grandmaster Kise, and he wanted me to help him in the dojo and help teach and do all that. So I spent a lot of time with him. And then so Grandmaster Uehara had a significant impact on me. He was 96 years old. He was the head of the Motobu Ru system, Motobu Bu Seidokan. And was not one of his students, but he would invite me to train with his senior students on the weekends. Every Sunday, he would spend 4 hours at the Nagagasuku Castle Grounds because he said practice should be where the warrior spirits still linger. And he said, the warrior spirits will always be around the castle grounds. So we would spend 4 hours with his 5,000 and above, and I would be included in there. He would invite me over, and every week, and he was 96 at that time, and he would videotape every workout, and he would critique every workout, and he would demonstrate techniques like no 90-something-year-old person thought could do. And then every week he had a surprise for his senior students. He would bring in somebody from outside the system to kind of humble you, just to let you know you're not perfect. This one weekend, the first weekend that I went out, that he invited me out there to work out with his students, he invited two of the instructors from the Kodokan Academy, judo instructors in Tokyo, to come down and pass us around. Well, I did have some jiu-jitsu in my background, and I was very strong. And neither of the two judo instructors was able to overpower me. That just impressed the heck out of him. So he kind of took me under his wing. So, you know, different systems, but they were all so nice and generous. And this person obviously has a little talent. Let me see if I can hone that talent a little bit more. So they treated me like their son. Now we've got three different systems here. We got Ishin Ryu, we got Shorin Ryu, and then Shorin Ryu Kenshin Kan, and then we had Motobu. And I felt at home wherever I went. And those are memories, and I got pictures. You got a picture of me when you put up the Pat podcast announcement. You got a picture of me with Sensei Yuahara. He was the 11th disciple of the Motobu system going back to the 1400s. And he was 96 at that time. His sensei and him as a student went to Japan to teach karate from Okinawa at the same time that Funakoshi left Okinawa to go to Japan to teach karate. So there was a lot of history there.
Well, you do realize when you say impact, you've been impacted by these people. They've shared with you it's a great privilege to be in their presence, to learn from them.
It was humbling, and it was an honor, and it was just something I never expected.
Right, right. And then, of course, when you face these two judo players and they're not able to dominate, the sensei looks and says, well, wait a minute now. These two guys come from, you know, the Kodokan in Japan. These are instructors.
Yes.
This guy should have a problem with them. Whereas, you know, they weren't able to, I guess, have their way. So
no,
you were able
not.
To defend. Yeah, you were able to defend. So now, because of your martial arts background at this point now, you face these two players. As you said, you have some jiu-jitsu background, but these are two instructors from, you know, judo.
Yes.
And they're very good. You know,
I was surprised.
I know. Sensei Kate told me the same thing, that when, because I think he was a two-time, I know he won the championship several times while he was there, serving as a Marine. Ernie Cates is his name.
Right. Yes, I remember the name.
Yes. And he said the same thing to me in an interview where players came from the Kodokan, and he was asked to go out there with them and, you know, go play judo. And he did very well, and they were quite impressed with him. Now, again, Sensei Kate's another great Marine, okay?
Yes.
He has an extensive background, as you do, sir, in the Marine Corps.
Yes.
So another great American, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So, you know, you put these guys together, Phil, and as you said now, being overseas, let me ask this question. When you're overseas and you're training, what's the difference between the way we train here in America and the way they train in the Orient?
It was very different. There are no excuses. There's no timeout. It's not about being polite or taking it easy. It's about spending 4 solid hours after you exhausted. I don't see that in the average dojo any place else other than Okinawa. I don't see that kind of dedication and refusing to quit and just continuing to go until you drop. I don't see it. I didn't see it. Over here, it was just a little bit too much liability, and you couldn't push because then you would lose the students. Okay? I saw a difference.
Question, Phil. You said the key word there. I would lose the students.
Yes.
Well, listen. You know.
I retired from Okinawa, by the way, and my last tour, 1999 to 2000. I got to spend a lot of personal time with Grandmaster Angie Uesu and with Grandmaster Fusei Kisa and with Grandmaster Uehara. I got not only did I get to work out, but I also they called me a friend, and I would also spend time with them, whether at their house or I invite them over to the officers' club and treat them to dinner, the whole family. But we spent a lot of time together. That's an honor that I could not have envisioned.
Well, I would like to say this about Uesu Sensei. In my lifetime, he has made such an effort to perpetuate his father-in-law's art of Ishinryu.
Yes.
That he's come
yes.
to this country more times than I can remember. He's like one of the hardest working senseis ever.
Yes.
He's such a genuine human being, my God.
Absolutely.
Any question you may have
And he kept teaching and working after his heart attack, and he was paralyzed. He kept teaching. And he was still able to put me down when half of his side is paralyzed, and yet he was still able to put me down at his dojo. I was the seventh down at that time.
Well, you see, you know, impact. That's something you'll never
yes.
forget. The man's hurt, you know, but he still has such
yes.
a will. That
yes.
I love him so much. He's such a great man to me. When he made the films, when he put them out
yes.
for us all to see back in the 70s.
He personally gave me my own copy of everything. Never had
I
a
love
little
him.
Penny. He just wanted me to have a copy of all his tapes. Every kata, every movement, everything.
I love him. I love him very much.
As we all do.
A great man, great ambassador. Great sensei. He's in good hands.
Great human being.
Yes. Oh, yes. I understand that Hanchi Chris Chase,
okay.
and Andy Sloan Sensei, because he's in
yes.
the Navy right now serving on the island,
right.
they take very good care of him. They go
that's,
see him.
That's fantastic.
They ask him if he needs anything. They bring him stuff.
Right. He makes sure that he gave me the best Grandmaster Uesu. He makes sure that he gave me the best going away party when I retired from Okinawa to come back to the United States. That was my last tour in the Marine Corps. That made it, you know, I was going on 35 years at that time. He makes sure he got all of the students and senseis and families, and he gave me the best farewell party at the Staff and CO Club at Camp Butler.
Wow.
Yes.
That's history.
I got pictures of that.
Well, it's a piece of issue of history. I mean,
That is. But he went out of his way to plan a farewell party for me.
He's a genuine soul. I love that man. He really is.
Absolutely.
What a gem. You know, what a gem of a
yes.
man.
Yes. Completely
again,
agree.
I can only aspire to be like him, you know. But at least I have him.
Can only dream.
Yes, I have him as a, like you say, a mentor, a hero, somebody
yes.
to look up to, somebody to try to emulate. Just very inspiring. That's all, Phil.
Extremely
human being. You know. So, all right, keep going. So now, what else you got for us? Because this is I'm like a kid in a candy store when you talk about Uizu
so
and all these people.
Well, so am I. I'm trying to make sure we didn't leave anybody out that was one of those impact persons. Jody Paul was another one who had a significant impact on me. I went down to Georgia for my last command tour at the submarine base there. I was the commander of the Marine Corps Security Force down there. And then I found out that he has a dojo right outside the base, not far from the base. So I visited him shortly after I got there. And the next 2 years, he and I just did everything we possibly could together, including going down to spend some time with Thomas LaPuppet down in Orlando together. And I got pictures of that. So that's another person. Jody Paul was a retired Navy SEAL, and then he was working down there as a civilian at the base. But he had the best dojo outside the base, and I would be in there a few nights a week helping him teach, and he and I working out. And it was just he made those 2 years very special.
Now, how about weapons, Bill? Can we talk a little bit about weapons? Because that's also part of our study. So
absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about the weapons training, some of the sensei, some of the people that you encountered to get this information.
Okay. When it comes to the SAI, I would always refer to Bill Hayes and his SAI kata. I don't think I've seen anything even come close to Bill Hayes. I'm involved with Professor Gary Lee as I help him run a major event that he has every year, and I hope you're able to make it one of this year's in Houston. Where we have the Living Legends event. And we have all of the icons from, many of the icons from the 70s, 80s, 90s. It could be Bill Wallace, Chuck Norris. It could be 100 other icons that come down. Professor Gary Lee has this unique tournament. It's called the Pro Kata War. okay? And it's open to all styles. It could be empty hand. It could be traditional. It could be modern. It could be weapons. Some of the best weapons people that I know participate in that annual event. And these are people that have won usually around 100 first places around the nation or around the world. And they come in for the bragging rights of being the best of the best. Doesn't matter the system. It could be kung fu. It could be karate. It could be anything. It could be weapon. It could be empty hand. But they all compete on the same platform to be the best of the best. This is a pro tournament. And Gary Lee runs that, and he does a superb job. And I'm one of the judges at that event. And I sincerely hope you can make it. Yeah. But what did you have in mind for weapons?
Well, you know, in Ishiru we have the sai, the bow.
Yes. Yes.
And the tampa.
Yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with those.
So I am. That and the nunchucks.
Yeah, it's a good place to start.
Right. So I've really enjoyed my time with weapons. I haven't handled weapons as I once did. I handle them occasionally now, but I still have them. I still pick them up. I still take them outside. I still go through a routine, whether it's the tanfa, the bow, and every single item that I have, I got from one of the senseis in Okinawa.
Wow.
So it was
That's really cool.
It's not the lightweight stuff that you see at some tournaments for the kama. It's a real kama that you can go out to the field and cut vegetation. Same thing with the bow, the nunchuck, or the sides. And Grandmaster Kisei makes sure that I have each one of those because on the weekends I would go with them and we would demonstrate some of them at various events. But I love them. They're part of who we are as in martial artists. I wish I would spend more time with them, but I haven't, but I should. They're always going to be part of us. They're always going to be part of me.
Because, again, impact. You know, they have a tremendous impact on our life.
Yes.
I love the weapon. One of the things really interests me about martial arts is when you put a weapon in. I grew up with Ronald Duncan. So,
I understand.
You know, watching him handle weapons and asking questions, sensei, what do I do here? How do I hold this? The position is blocked, you know. What happens when the together and you get that reverberation in your hand, you know? All of these things. So I love weapons. I love to work with weapons.
I do too.
You know, when you get a student that has been around long enough now, weapons with them, they're getting really good. I mean, I'm saying reflexes, my stamina, not what when I was in my 20s. However,
right.
As you said before, you get to a point where you're about to collapse and for another because you don't want to quit.
Right.
You find the energy.
The energy is there. It's just your mind doesn't know it until you push it, and then later realize it was always there. It's just that you extend the limits of your mind to accept whatever you have to accept.
What's the difference right there?
Yes. Yes.
See, I didn't serve in the Marine Corps, but I was part of McMap. The training that I went to under his command taught me something.
Right. Yes.
It's just that. I don't care you're tired. I don't care you want to collapse. You're going to continue. We'll continue. That's it. It's mindset, Daniel.
Absolutely. But in the MacMap side of the house, you don't have a choice to collapse. You collapse, you die. Because everything you're doing is about it's about life or death. So stopping is not a choice.
That's right.
I think we're breaking up. I think we're breaking up, Hanshi.
Yeah, that happened.
Yeah, okay. Now I can hear you again.
Yeah, that happens. We're both on cell phones, I'll bet. That's why.
Yes, we are.
But it's amazing that you said that. That's the key, folks. Did you hear that, listeners? When you get tired and you feel like you just can't go anymore. We made the analogy on last night's program like this. If I was to ask any loyal listener that's listening in, fill up the bathtub. I want you to hold your breath for 2 minutes in the bathtub. Oh, I can't hold my breath for 2 minutes. That's a long time. Navy SEALs do it as a routine training. So don't tell me it can't be done. It can be done. You just have to tell yourself and learn the technique how to hold your breath for 2 minutes underwater.
Absolutely.
So you said a very key thing about with the McMap program, if you stop, you die.
Yes.
I like that analogy.
So stop. Stopping is not an option.
It's not an option. It's not. I work with a gentleman here in Raleigh that served in the Marine Corps, and he went through the program. So when he met me, when I got my job there, I mentioned that because I was wearing a globe and anchor on my hat.
Right.
And I got it from my father-in-law, Mr. McGrath.
Right.
And he asked me, he said, did you serve? I said, no. I said, but I was involved with the McMap program with Colonel Shusko. And we hit it off because.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure you know Joe. I'm sure you know Joe. I was in the presence of Ernie Cates, Ed McGrath, Don Bohan, Arsenio Advincula.
Yeah.
Who else was there? There was some other people there from other disciplines. But anyway, our people, the Ishinru people, we were all working out, and Colonel came over and introduced himself. We were invited there by Mark Sensei. Ed McGrath got the invitation to go down to Jacksonville.
Right.
And we were there working out, and he came over, and he saw it was a hot day, Colonel. It was a hot day that day, and we were all sweating. And he said, it's nice to see a bunch of guys doing the work. And he introduced himself. He said, you know, come on over. I want to show you what's going on. And, you know, a wonderful experience. Just a great, great impact on my life to be around those people and doing the work, Colonel. So,
right.
You know, weapons, when you teach weapons, what are one of the things that you ask the students to pay attention to?
I'm sorry?
When you are on the deck and you're teaching, let's say, weapons, what's one of the things that you ask the student to pay attention to? Is it the handling of the weapon, the positioning of the hands, or what's the one thing that you really have to get across?
Well, for me, it's the same thing as with the empty hand. When I'm watching a movement, when I'm watching a kata, what I'm asking myself, would that movement do what it is intended to do? Whether it's with a bow, with a side of empty hand, whether it's a kick or a punch or a block, would that movement that you just performed be able to do what it was intended to do or what you think it can do? If it isn't, what I'm looking for is the performance, the power, the speed, whether that would have stopped an opponent, whether it be with a bow or with an empty hand. And that's what I try to get them to focus on. Everything you do has got to be based on real life. That's my perspective. That's my mantra. Okay. If it isn't, I don't want to see it. If it isn't, then it's a waste of time. I realize we do some things just to demonstrate, maybe a breathing exercise or do a tension kata. So we do things that are slow on purpose. But outside of those demonstrated purposeful techniques, everything that I want to see and what I help on and what I'll push is with that punch, with that kick, or would that bow have had enough of an impact to disable an opponent. So that's what I'm watching for. That's the frame of mind that I'm in. That's the criteria that I'm looking for.
Yes.
Is it a wasted movement, or would it have had the intended effect? If not, then you either need a lot of practice or you need to do something else.
Well, again, I'll refer to what you said about Hey Sensei. When you saw him doing the kata, you invited to take a look at those movements because
yes,
you could see where it started, you could see where it ended, but you couldn't see in between because
the
movements were so...
That's how fast he was, and that's how efficient he was.
Yes, yes. And the weapon is nothing more than an extension of my hand.
Correct.
So if my punch doesn't move you, my weapon's probably not going to move you either.
That's exactly my take. That's really what I was trying to get at when you asked me the question.
Okay.
It doesn't matter what's in your hands, so if there's anything in your hands, is the movement you're doing going to have the intended effect? If not, you're wasting my time.
Now, let me ask you this. This is a question that I often get asked as an instructor. Let's say I have a student, brand new student now, doesn't know any martial arts. They come in the door, they want to take lessons, and you show them, let's say, a basic stance, a basic punch, a basic block, a basic kick, or snap kick, whatever. You spend your time, let's say, 2-3 months working with this person to teach them proper stance, proper balance, breathing, all these things.
Right.
After you've spent, let's say, 2 or 3 months with this person, and they're still not meeting the criteria of proper stance, proper focus, proper punch, all this stuff, hitting their targets. What's your means and methods to get them to perform the way you want?
Well, behavior does not change. I've done a lot of leadership seminars, okay? Behavior does not change unless there's a consequence. Behavior changes only when the person knows there's a consequence. So I'm going to have to set out some sort of consequence, whether it is perhaps this is not what you thought it would be, and perhaps this is not for you, or perhaps you need some further instruction for me to spend more time with you. But there has to be some consequence that I would need, that needs to be imposed in order for behavior to change or the attitude to change. And if there is no consequence, and if I just let it go and 3 months, a month later is still the same thing, again, I'm going to have to approach and direct and either terminate or do this extra stuff.
Well, you see, this is why you made it to the rank of colonel, because you have the discipline that says, I have a set of rules that you have to adhere to. Now,
yes.
I see you trying. I'll give you that. You are trying. But you're either not doing your homework. Let's say I get you for 2 hours of class 3 or 4 times a week. What is that? 6 hours, 8 hours? That's not a lot of time.
Right.
So I expect you now to go home, get into the stance that I showed you. I give you all the tools. I make a straight line for you. And you put your heel here, you put your toe here. Should be about shoulders distance away. Very simple. I'm not asking for anything that's difficult. You're in such a routine that you're not, you never pay attention to how you walk. You just walk. Well, in martial arts, we have some rules about walking around.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely.
We need you to stay on balance when you walk around. You just can't shrug your shoulders and walk around like you think you're walking in the park. So, again, Colonel, this was a great just spending time together talking about this stuff. It's just it's what I live for, really.
Well, this is why you and I decided to do this, so that someday we can sit back and smile at the memories.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I do. As you you mentioned, that some of the Marines that were under your command from all over the world now will just pop in a message or send you something or call you, say hello, or stop and see you if they're close enough, whatever.
Yep.
These relationships that you build over your lifetime during your journey, as you said, when some of your people have transitioned, you were very sad because you had such great times with these people. You exchanged, maybe you broke bread with them.
Yep.
All very meaningful and wholesome. Which brings me to my next point, Phil. The situation that the world is in today, with so much hatred and disenchantment and unrest. You being a military man your whole life, probably seeing the worst of the worst. What's your message, Phil? What can we do to love one another?
Well, for one thing, we cannot give up. we may see part of our society crumbling, but we're not going to join the bunch that's crumbling. We are going to continue to want, set the right example, the example that you want to see in others, and two, trying to cement whatever sphere of influence you have, so that you can do your part in keeping the society from breaking down. And you extend that out as far as you can within your sphere of influence. The option of giving up on society is not an option. You just got to do all you can and maybe a little bit more, and you teach through modeling the behavior you want to see in others.
I agree to that, yes. Okay. So what you're telling us is keep your head down, go to work, continue to spread your wholesomeness in whatever way you can.
Yes.
And don't focus on the bad. Focus on the good.
No. If you're going down the road, and when I was teaching evasive driving on the track, you learn to not look at the cones that you got to go around. You learn to look at the section in between the cones, and that keeps you straight on the lanes. So you can't focus on the bad, because all you're going to do is hit the bad cone. You got to focus on the space in between the bad cones so you can continue to speed ahead.
Yes. You learn the technique. You practice the technique. Yes. You learn how to focus. You learn the discipline of how you maneuver.
Yes.
And you practice that, you get better and better. You learn
and
the time.
Real life is no different.
Yes.
You do the same thing.
Yeah. Well, now, let's talk about your competition shooting, because it's
okay.
Something that I know you're very proficient at. And, you know, they keep saying gun laws, gun laws, gun laws. We got enough gun laws. What we need to do is we need to train.
Yes.
We need to enforce them, yes, but we need to train. In America, we need to train. We need to protect these children. All right?
Yes, we do.
Children are vulnerable. They go to school thinking that they're going in that building to learn something, and they wind up dead. So we need to train. So let's talk a little bit about your competition shooting, Bill, please.
Okay.
For instance,
what question? Go ahead.
Well, what is a weapon of choice when you're going to go into a competition shooting? What kind of weapon would you put in your hand?
Okay. Give me 1 second. I gotta put my phone on mute for just about 15 seconds. Okay.
Yes, sir. While the colonel is on mute, we're going to take the last portion of the program and talk about his shooting competitions. So it's very interesting, because shooting competitions have a timing. There's requirements. It's a lot of stuff. It takes a lot of practice to get good at it. So when he comes back on, we'll resume our conversation. We didn't even take a halftime break. I mean, here it is, I guess an hour and 35 minutes into the program, and we haven't even stopped. We haven't even taken a break. So this is just awesome. What a great interview, man, I'm telling you. It's definitely one for the ages. But, you know, look, you know, this is why we invite people of this ilk onto the program, because look at the information that we shared tonight. Look at some of the names that we talked about. Well, just us talking about them keeps them alive. You know, by us mentioning their names and talking about the things that they did, some of the stuff that they shared with us, it's very wholesome. It's a very gratifying situation, because at the end of the day, we're just trying to do the work. We're just trying to get some information so that, you know, maybe our practice will get a little better. You know, maybe some of the routines that we do will get a little bit more in depth. We'll be able to explain things to us. That's okay. I was just talking to the audience while you were talking.
I've been listening. But you wanted
it's
to talk about shooting.
I did. I wanted to get into it because we have about 20 minutes left to the show. So I wanted to close with the shooting competition, because there's a lot of things that go into the preparation of learning how to shoot, learning what the rules are, and then, of course, becoming proficient at hitting the target. So,
but
if he was going to go into a tournament.
Yes, okay. But the ultimate goal of all that is for you to feel confident about your abilities in handling the various tools that can come into your hands, real life or not. So, for example, you asked me about what type of firearms. And the types of firearms run the whole gamut, because we have competitions that include all of the firearms. The one shooting sport that I have been most involved with is IDPA, International Defensive Pistol Association. Everything in IDPA is a simulation of real life. So if you are at a local competition, you may be shooting five different scenarios of actual events. If you are at a sanctioned competition or at the national level competition, you may be shooting 15 or 20 different scenarios of things that have actually happened or can happen. Whether you reacting to a carjacking, coming of a car, engaging threats with innocents in between, whether if you're reacting to a home invasion and you got four people coming in through your door and you got family to protect and you got threats to assess, to engage. So in IDPA, everything you do is based on real life scenarios. So I have spent decades involved in IDPA type shooting, because that's the one sport that's most realistic, most resembles real life, okay? And when you are engaging targets, you always going to have targets that are no-shoot targets. In other words, the friendlies between the bad guys, okay? And when you hit a friendly, you're going to get heavily penalized. And each threat has to be addressed and engaged so that it is out of the way. So you got to get so many hits, and your hits got to be at a certain spot, and you're on the clock. So your time and your accuracy are both equal factors. You got to be fast and you got to be accurate, and you got to engage all of the threats, and then you have to engage all of the threats based on the level of perceived threat. somebody who's very close to you is going to be a much bigger threat, because regardless of his skills, he'll likely not miss you if he's shooting at you. Somebody who's far away may miss you, may miss hitting you if they're shooting at you, because they may not have your skill level. Okay, so you learn to address threats based on the significance of the threat. We may have shooting in low light situations where you're using a flashlight. We may be clearing a whole house, a shoot house, and you clear in many, many rooms, and there are ways for you to clear rooms, just like a SWAT team would, okay? So in IDPA, you face those type of scenarios. In some of the other sports, and of course, in IDPA, you're shooting from a cover position as much as possible, whereas in the other shooting sports, you're trying to be as fast as you can, and you're trying to be as accurate as you can. You're not moving to the same degree, or you're not relying on finding cover to hide behind while you're shooting. There are many different sports out there, and you got, so it could be IDPA, where most people are using a basically stock handgun. And now we also have a pistol caliber division. And it's no different than being in the martial arts. You progress and you get a green belt, you get a brown belt, you get a black belt, and you're competing. Green belts are competing with green belts. And in IDPA or some of the other sports, that marksman is competing with other marksmen, and sharpshooters are competing with sharpshooters, and experts are competing with experts, and masters are competing with masters. So you're competing within your lane of ability. So everybody, at the end of the day, when all the scores are total, you get judged based on the people that you are there to compete against, which are people of approximate equal skill level, okay? And it could be a handgun, or it could be a carbine in a pistol caliber, like a 9mm or 40 or 45 or 10mm. And then in some of the other sports, you're using a race gun in IFSC, National Shooting Practical Association, or USPSA. You're running and gunning, and you're going fast, and you're being accurate. You don't have to worry about cover. You don't have to worry about dropping ammunition or dropping magazines, whereas in IDPA, you can't do that. And you can be hitting many more targets with many more rounds than in IDPA. And you can be in a three-gun competition. In a three-gun competition, you got rifle, shotgun, and handgun. You got some stages that are going to be pure rifle stages. At a local competition, there may be 5 or 50 yards at a national match. You may be engaging those targets with rifle at a fairly fast speed at 500 yards, okay? And then you got to engage some close targets. And then you put that in a barrel, you put the rifle in a barrel, and you pick up the shotgun, and you may have to knock down 10 or 11 or 15 steel plates with the shotgun. And the shotgun, you finish the shotgun portion of it, and then that shotgun goes in the barrel, and then you finish up the paper targets or some steel targets with your handgun. Then you transition from one to the other. So, and so it's a I may have 25 different firearms that I can pick with at one time or another, some of them at the same time. Okay.
Well, you know, going through this training and making these split-second decisions.
Yeah, nanoseconds. Yeah.
I'm thinking to myself, how can we use this? There's people out there that do this training. You're not the only one. So
there are many.
I'm thinking, of course there are. But I'm thinking to myself, how can we employ this type of training to protect these children?
Well, first, we have to convince the people in the elected or appointed positions, first, we have to convince them that this is the right path. Many of them are not have a different values and a different philosophy, and so many of them don't. A firearm doesn't come into the equation, period. It doesn't matter how much sense you make. A firearm is not part of their equation.
Then can we do it with a non-lethal source? Can we do it with,
yes.
with some?
Yes, we can.
If we can't use ammo, because they won't say yes to that. We have to devise a way with training that we can do it with a non-lethal way then.
Well, you would common sense would tell you that at the very least we should employ that. There are people still that would not accept that. People in our society in powerful positions who would fight you on that.
We'll tell that to the parents of the children that were lost. Those parents would say yes to anything because now they lost their child.
I agree. It needs to be done. Many things need to be done. There isn't one solution. Many things need to be done. The schools need to be hardened. There has to be the only way to stop a bad person with a gun is to have a good person with a gun stopping that person.
Yes, Bill.
But we
That's
cannot.
What happened.
But we cannot convince some people in powerful positions that's a solution. There is no opening, no leeway, no transition. I've taught gun safety at schools in the past. I can't do that today.
Bill, the children have to prevail here. We have to put them first. We have to take this word politics out of it. We have to go back to wholesomeness.
But that's you and I talking. Some people don't think like we do.
Even though the children are dying.
To put it bluntly, some people think differently and they want different solutions, and some of their priorities are different. Yes.
Okay. I can only say this in response to that then. May I have the United States Marine Corps protect my schools?
I would certainly hope so.
That would be my request. Bill, if you want to put up if you want to put up any resistance to us trying to fix the problem, then could I please ask for protection by the United States Marine Corps around every school in this 50 states?
They're
allowed to have guns. The Marine Corps is allowed to have guns. So could I have the Marine Corps?
Yeah.
Can I have a division of the Marine Corps that's dedicated to protecting our schools?
There are deans. There are principals. There are who run schools and run districts, district superintendents, who would not allow a uniformed police officer in the building because it scares some of the students.
So then let's use Ronald Duncan's theory. The Marines will be unseen. We will play.
You will get no argument from me. But the argument.
No, I know that, Colonel. I know you won't put up any resistance.
You got it. But the argument that you get from elected officials and appointed officials and school superintendents are arguments that would not make sense to you and I.
Okay.
The safety of those kids should be a priority. Everything else should be secondary. The safety and the education of the safety and the education of those kids should be the only two factors. Everything else should be left at the door. That's not how it's working right now.
Well, that's why I asked for the Marine Corps.
I fully understand you. And I'll be the first one there at the door.
I know that. So that's why I'm saying if we could get our Marines to protect our children, then they'll stop killing our children.
Well, we need to teach local people, and a lot of states have already passed laws allowing teachers. Some states have already passed laws allowing teachers to be trained and to be armed. But there are still many, many, many districts fighting that.
Oh, well, I mean, if the shooter is going to come in with a gun and I have a bullhorn, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
He's still going to shoot. So I need something to respond with.
I agree with you, but that's not how some see it. Politics come first.
Well, no, what really has to happen then is I have to get elected president, and I have to make a mandatory rule that everybody coming out of high school does 2 years in the United States Marine Corps. Everybody. Men, women, children, everybody. A minimum of 24 months. So that,
yes, Mr. President.
It would be the first thing I would put into law. All my students are going in the military. He's all going to learn how to fight.
I would say that every citizen needs to do some time in doing some national service.
Right. Even if it's in the National Guard, whatever, I don't care. But they got to go to
national service.
Yes. Somebody's got to teach them how to fight. Because, look, this has been happening more and more often. Yes, they fly the flags at half staff. And yes, they make the memorials and all this stuff. I cannot understand what these parents are going through. I can't.
And we never will. We can't. The society has to do a better job at identifying and correcting the problem. Anyway, going back to the different firearms for competition, there are many, and it depends on what division you want to shoot, whether you shoot in revolver division, whether you shoot in a carbine, pistol caliber carbine division, whether you shoot in a stock handgun out of the box, Glock, whether you shoot in an enhanced division where you've made some modifications to that, whether you shoot in a pistol with an optic or iron sights. So all of those divisions are out there, and most of us compete in all of those divisions at one time or another.
You know, we got about 2 or 3 minutes left before the live portion goes off. You know, just tell us,
yes, sir.
If someone wanted to get a hold of you to get some lessons or maybe just talk to you about their martial arts, how would they get a hold of you? Would you care to share that?
For one, I interact with a lot of friends and with the public on Facebook, so they can always find me on Facebook. They can always send me a PM. They can send me a text to my phone. We can have conversations on the phone like I do every week with someone. I spend time mentoring people in different states every week on the phone or on a Zoom call or by text or email. So in any way possible.
Well, you know, we say thank you for spending a couple of hours with us tonight. Sharing your journey with our loyal listeners. We didn't get to any of the callers. We had a full switchboard tonight. The chat board was going through the whole show. All of this stuff will be archived, Phil. If you want to share the link with any of the people that you mentor or teach or interact with, by all means do so. What an honor, what a privilege to spend this time with you. Thank you, sir.
Well, the honor was mine, my friend. So thank you for the invitation.
Well, we got to do this again. So
absolutely.
You're invited anytime.
Let's make time for callers, okay?
Yes.
People calling in to have a question. All right, sir?
Thank you so much once again, and stay safe, stay healthy, keep kicking, punching. The work you do is just incredible. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Well, there you have it, folks. You know, another edition of the Issue Room Match Podcast with Phil Torres. You know, again, it's one for the ages. I know I'll certainly listen to this program several times to try to keep up going over all the people that we mentioned tonight. You know, just what a great gift to be sitting in this chair tonight. So stay tuned for tomorrow's program. It'll be Thursday night on the mat, and we'll have couple of my students join us to talk about our experience working out, you know, on the mat and getting a good sweat going. So thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good night.
enough to me. Love comes out of nowhere, baby, just like a hurricane, and it feels like rain. Oh, it feels like rain. Lying here
and you